Wanted to talk with you this evening. Really what I'm going to be talking about is meditation practice. Let me just ask, those of you here, how many of you have a regular meditation practice? And it's no shame if you don't. Very good. Very good. So it's almost like not quite unanimous, but all of us are doing this. How many of you have had a meditation practice, but aren't really up with it perhaps now? Okay, good. All right, so here's the thing. If I were to tell you that there was a pill that you could take that would reduce stress, reduce anxiety, limit any sorts of fear, boost your immune system, clarify your thinking, and a whole other sorts of benefits, and also had no harmful side effects, would it be something you might be interested in? Well, I'm glad to see that, because I have some for sale. But no. Obviously, if that something like that existed, we'd be all in. It would be something that'd be a no-brainer. It'd be like taking a vitamin in the morning, no harmful side effects. But the fact is that those are the benefits just on the level of the physical side of things, of meditation. So I'm going to talk a little bit about it and some of the ways in which, some of the areas in consciousness in which, to which it can take us as well. Here's an example. If you can, just imagine a stream of water. You know, we've seen these little streams out in the woods, but every now and then where there's a stream, you'll find that off to the side of it, there's a pool, just a little quiet pool that comes into being as the water flows by and a little bit flows into this little inlet. And what ends up happening is you have this separate little system. It's fed by the stream, but in this little separate area, you have all kinds of different life that you don't find in the mainstream. Plants, you know, little animals, fish that swim around in this pool. For all intents and purposes, it looks like something that's constant. It looks like something that has a certain stable reality. This pond, you know, we'll use it as an image for us. Because in a sense, what's happening is this, that for us, when we look at this sort of pool, just to the normal sort of way of observing, if we look at it and if the surface of the water is not calm, then basically all we see is water and nothing else. But there's all kinds of things going on beneath the surface. All kinds of life forms that are moving, that are making their way, that are doing the things that they do, all contained within this one sort of pond, this one pool. So I'm using that simply as an example of what it is that's really happening with each and every one of us. We're very complex beings. It's a simple thing when we say, I. Generally, we tend to point to the body. You know, who am I? I've pointed this out before. I don't fully understand it, but I know the Tibetans, when they talk about I, they seem to point to their nose. And I don't know why they do that. Say, I am doing something, and they point to their nose. So I assume it's just a cultural difference. But we always seem to point to something related to this body. And we tend to think of it as one thing. Whoever I am is something that is unique, that is identifiable, that is self-contained, and that has some sort of permanence. And we're content with that. And so this is the level of looking at this I from the perspective of just seeing the surface of the waters. But we all know that underneath those surfaces, there are many, many things that are going on inside of us continually. From moment to moment, there are thoughts that are surging in our mind, passing through, you know, like so many fish swimming in the water. Emotions. Emotions arise, emotions die down, and the water churns, and the water becomes still. We have these things going on continually. Largely, unless we start to become a little bit observant of ourselves, they go on and it's like weather, we don't quite know why. You know, something's happening and I'm a little upset today, but you know, these things happen and that's good enough. But there's this other level of being able to, this level of self-examination that can take place through different mediums. But meditation is one that I'm going to suggest. It's an interesting fact, which I just became aware of. When we talk about, again, who I am, just at the physical level, you all probably already know this. When we talk about I, in terms of this physical body, the cells that comprise a physical body are trillions in number. But within the physical body, there are 10 times more bacteria cells than there are normal human cells. 10 times more. If it weren't for the fact that they were so much smaller than the normal human cell, we'd have to all look like Paul Bunyan or the Hulk or something like that just to contain them. 10 times more cells. And you know, the fact of the matter is that these are cells that we couldn't live without. So really, we are more bacteria than we are human. I mean, if you want to just talk facts, if numbers are the things that talk, we are more bacteria than we are human. And in the absence of bacteria, human life could not exist. And it's a constant interchange of my bacteria sharing with yours. It's constantly going on. And so, yeah, I say that just because somewhere along the line, it's a very healthy thing, it's very useful for us to loosen this sort of grasp we have on this sense that I is a very well-defined, very self-contained sort of entity. It's healthy. So we'll talk a little bit more about that, perhaps. This one I can't resist sharing with you. They did a study. This is science people who got a grant to do this sort of thing, to study bacteria on the human body, not in. And so the place they chose to check, they took 95 people and they checked their belly buttons. They did a swab on the belly button to see what sort of bacteria they found. 95 people, they found 1,400 different types of bacteria. 662 of those had never been identified before. So, you know, I think every one of us here has the potential for getting a grant if this is the sort of thing they're paying for. But it's just an interesting side fact. But we are composed of a lot of different things, is all I'm saying. And the borderline between where I end and where you begin might not be as clearly defined as we think. I mean, I'm very much aware of this now because I just got off this plane with all these folks, and as sometimes happens, you pick up something that somebody else had. And so here I am, and I don't know which one of those 200 people it was. I don't like him, whoever he was. But I don't know which one it was, but we shared this environment, and it's something that's a part of our reality, is that our reality is a shared reality. So anyway, in terms of our approach to understanding, Socrates had said that the unexamined life is not worth living. So at a certain point, just looking at the surface of the water doesn't content us anymore. I mean, there comes a time where we have to look a little bit deeper and try and understand what actually this environment that we call I contains. And we start to examine the contents, and we start to become aware of the emotional tendencies. If you have any sort of inclination towards the ageless wisdom teachings, you also start to become aware that there are, you know, such things as forms that take place from thoughts, from emotions, and that they're constantly being generated. We're constantly interacting with those. Again, just a regular sort of scientific fact, the electromagnetic field, and we're not talking aura, we're not talking anything kind of that someone might say New Age, but the electromagnetic field generated by someone's heart extends 10 feet out from the body. I mean, can be measured if you had the instrument for it. You could just hold it here and you could measure the electromagnetic field being generated by any one of us. And this is happening, you know, here's a room, 40, 30, 40 people, constantly going on. And so, you know, we wonder why we have certain thoughts sometimes. We wonder why we feel certain ways sometimes. I mean, perhaps for those people who are able to actually see these sorts of things, they would be able to point to it and identify what's going on. So at a certain point, we decide that we need to look a little bit deeper. And so this can take a number of different avenues. The one, of course, is the avenue of examining the contents of our own consciousness. And this is where meditation becomes an invaluable sort of tool. There are many different ways that a person can actually sit and meditate. Actually, meditation boils down to one thing when it's all said and done, no matter which form, no matter which technique you practice. I always find myself coming back to Lama Anagarika Govinda's quote on what is meditation. He was asked, what is meditation? And his response, which I love, was, meditation is not what you think. It took a while, but you got it, right? Meditation is not what you think. Anything at the point that we find ourselves in this process of thinking, that's not meditation. So most of what we do when we say we are practicing meditation is not actually meditation, but the practice of that which leads up to the actual experience of meditating. Necessary background, but still, it's good to be able to distinguish. So there are many different forms that one could engage in. One of the ones that now has become so very popular and is also mainly one of the main ones studied in terms of the scientific approach to the effects of meditation is mindfulness or vipassana meditation, which really is just a matter of intently observing the present moment. So something as simple as paying attention to the way you're sitting in the chair. If right now you were to say, okay, let me focus on how this chair feels. You know, my behind is seated in the chair. What's the nature of the pressure there? Does it feel warm? Does it feel cool? Do I feel heavy as I sink into the seat? Basically, you've practiced mindfulness. You focused your attention on the experience of this moment. And it's a very useful approach because it's something that has universal application. So this is one of the ones that has been studied quite a bit. But the focus of meditation pretty much can go in three ways. And I think it necessarily has to begin with the first one, which is studying the contents of this pool that has formed alongside of the stream. That's where it begins, studying the contents of our own consciousness. With some attention to that, there will be this necessary experience that seems to follow along with it, which is that we start to become aware of ourselves as a functional unit within something that's greater. You know, much like the bacteria is something that's has its life, does its thing, but is also intimately associated with this greater life that is you or me. In many ways, we're just about like that. We live, we move, we have our being within something that is much greater. But the nature of that something is what it is that at some point we start to explore. So we move from the pool to the stream, the life-giving stream. And then, spoken of in the scriptures and the religious traditions of the world, you have this sort of, this ultimate experience, which they talk about merging, consciousness merging with the ocean of consciousness. The dewdrop slips into the shining sea is the way it's been described in different literature. So there's the possibility of this ultimate experience, but for us, the intermediate period is what we're talking about now. So what are the benefits of meditation? I think one of the things that goes on with the practice, anybody at some point in their life comes into, will ask themselves certain questions. I mean, often people talk about the big questions in life. You know, the big questions tend to be, who am I? You know, that ultimate one that you ask and give a variety of different answers to, depending on what stage in life we're in. Where am I going, or what is my purpose in life? These are some of the big questions. And in order to ask those questions, they begin with some level of understanding about something about this I. But I think there are a couple of intermediate questions that most people find themselves concerned with at various points in life. One of the questions which I think most people, at least for periods, want some sort of answer. Question might go something like this: how is it that in the midst of 7 billion people who are populating this planet, how is it that I feel lonely? You know, there's 7 billion folks out there. Everybody's looking for someone, but why do I feel lonely? Why do I feel somehow alone in this game? And it's a thought that comes, probably for everyone at some point. Another question that faces us anytime we get a little bit removed from our teenage years is, how do I function in life knowing that there's the certainty of death? You know, you stick around long enough and you start to lose any sense of doubt you might have once had that this is the direction that we're all headed in. You know, when you're young, you doubt or you don't even think about it. My father, he's 92 and he actually, this is the anniversary of my father's death, 8 years ago. But he used to say, he'd go home and he'd have to go out someplace, some sort of function or something like that, and he'd go to put his suit coat on. And every time he'd go to put his coat on, he'd look and he'd say, what is this in my pocket? And he pulls it out and it was the latest obituary. You know? You know, he was 90 years old. And so at that age, you know, your friends are starting to drop off. Although he was a remarkable man in that he had more friends my age than I did. I mean, he was remarkable with that. But as time moves on, the inevitability of certain things makes itself known. But also the fact, you know, for someone like that, I thought about that with my father. you're moving on, and as this happens, if you're fortunate enough to be healthy, then that means that you're outliving all of your friends. And at a certain point, the people who have escorted you along this journey, the people that have given of themselves, the people that have shown you love, the, you know, all of the things that make life possible and enjoyable, each one of them, one by one, becomes one of these papers in your suit coat. And so, you know, the idea, how is it? You know, who am I in the midst of this ever-swirling, constant sort of loss that's going on from moment to moment? And so these are questions that move us to look a little bit deeper. It's important. Because really, you know, as much as we like to think that, you know, it's about us, really, if we look at it, if we analyze it even slightly, we become aware that the moments that we feel that we were at our best, the moments when we were our happiest, the moments when we felt most fulfilled, somehow always relate to those moments when we were beyond being absorbed with ourselves, with our own needs, with our own wants. Somehow or another, the thing that has this liberating effect is our focus on others. It's a tonic. So, what is it in this, who are these others that can become our focus and that can become this liberating influence in our own lives? This is where we start thinking in terms of our connection with a greater life. That there is something more, just like the cell in our body participates in something much greater, we also participate in something much greater. And so we start to try and see the signs of that. See where it is that this something might be making itself known within us. Because actually, when it comes right down to it, whatever it is that's going on, we're the ultimate test for that. I like the way the Dalai Lama approaches it. He'll talk about these sorts of qualities of consciousness, and he'll talk about compassion, of course, and then he'll say that really for each one of us, we can prove it for ourselves because we have the greatest laboratory, most well-equipped laboratory that there is, and that's the laboratory of our own mind, of our own consciousness. So we can prove these things correct, or we can prove them incorrect. But it just takes the doing of it. So with meditation, this is one of these things that has been praised in every tradition, perhaps called by different names. For myself, I tend to link prayer and meditation. Very often people say that they're two different things. And I guess it depends on what level we approach it, but some people would say that prayer is talking to God. Meditation is listening to God. That's a cute way of saying it. And I think it's correct in some cases. But people talk about the practice of centering prayer or contemplative prayer. That type of prayer that is focused on bringing oneself so closely to that which is the divine that it has a certain immediacy that induces silence. Not too many years ago, I took my wife and daughter had never been to the Redwood Forest. I had when I was a kid. And we were driving across country. And so said, we're going to definitely stop here. And we did. And anyone who's ever been there, you walk into the forest and these huge old trees with trunks, you know, some of them almost as big as this room. And the thing that always happens when you step into the presence of these trees, for whatever reason, you find yourself whispering to each other. There's no reason for that. You're out in the woods. You can shout like you want to, but you find yourself whispering. And why? The grandeur, the beauty, the consciousness of these old trees. You know, they have those ones that they've cut down and they'll show where the rings are, and they have a little pin with the inscription on it said, this ring, Civil War. You know, this ring, whatever it is, but it keeps on going back. You have one ring, Christ was born. So that's an old tree. So you find yourself in the presence of these sorts of things, and the natural response, completely unthought, is stillness. Similarly, in certain forms of prayer, this is what happens. And to me, the stillness that takes place from having spoken and shut up is equal to the stillness that takes place from having shut up and shut up. Qualitatively, there is not a difference. And so, some of the effects. It's very interesting to me because they're doing a lot of study on this now. And so you have Harvard study, and they determined that 8 weeks of half an hour a day meditation practice, mindfulness practice, would bring about structural changes in the brain. Positive. When I say structural, it's not like you won't be lobotomized. It's positive structural changes in the brain. And the way that they're able to do this now, of course, they have the magnetic resonance imaging, you know, where they can take photos, really, of what's happening inside of the brain. And so they found that someone who will spend this 8 weeks, remarkable things start to happen. I mean, these are things that you would say, from a scientific point of view, you might say this is a little bit crazy. This is sci-fi. But what they find is there's one of the portions of the brain, which is spoken of as the old brain, the amygdala, which is the one that gets you so that you're ready to fight or you're ready to run. Fight, flight, or freeze is what they call it. So this is the one that it's a part of the brain, and it's a very old part of the brain. It was a very necessary part of the brain because there was a time when humans were under constant attack from their environment. And so they needed to be ready to go or to fight. And so this is something that has been interwoven, functionally connected with other regions of the brain, which is great, you know, when you're running away from wildebeest or dinosaurs or whatever it is. But in an environment where those things don't exist, what has happened is those threats to our person have been transferred to normal sorts of stresses during the course of our day. And so road rage might be an example of the amygdala overreacting. You know, somebody's stuck in traffic, another person drives by, looks at you in the wrong way, and next thing you know, there's a fight. That's the function of the amygdala, because it's connected to the other parts of the brain that invoke action. So what they found, though, is that 8 weeks, first of all, the amygdala shrinks. And another portion of the brain equally enlarges. And not only that, the function, the connectivity, which is to say the neurons, the nerve cells that connect with one another, are enhanced between a part of the brain that considers action before taking it and another part of the brain. I mean, these are physical changes in the brain. So that's been observed. But I love the quote. So this fellow who is one of the ones involved with this study was talking about mindfulness, and he says, "I'm really excited about the effects of mindfulness. It's been great to see it move away from being a spiritual thing towards proper science and clinical evidence." Which, you know, honestly, I love that. I really do. The idea that, he says, what does he say? He said, "Perhaps it's the new age, quasi-spiritual connotations of meditation that have so far prevented mindfulness from being hailed as an antidote to our increasingly frantic world. Research is helping to overcome this perception." So I do love that, though, because what it says to me is that the effects of meditation are reaching a broadening audience. And in all honesty, there is no requirement for any sort of spiritual dimension for meditation. The fact of the matter is that ultimately it leads in that direction, if it's pursued at all, but it's not a requirement. Quite honestly, if it were sufficiently beneficial to bring about relaxation and stress reduction, that would be a huge benefit in today's world. And the fact of the matter is, as the scientist says, he's so happy because this is in fact what it does. At the level that he's working with meditation, this is what it does. And so that's something that addresses every person that's alive, because nobody is without some forms of stress. For those who do feel that there is a spiritual component to living, then it takes on a deeper dimension. Then for that person, there is all of the benefits of relaxation, stress reduction, clearer thinking, boosted immune system, on and on and on. And additionally, there is the not guarantee of, but there is the, it certainly boosts the chances for genuine spiritual experience. And the interesting part about most people who are meditators is that very often the profound experiences that result from meditation occur when they're not meditating. It's an interesting thing. That the sorts of openings and the awarenesses that come upon one often come upon one because of the preparation that is made in the process of meditation. And so it's something that has a way of making itself known throughout the course of your daily life.
Historically, what role did the TS play in popularizing meditation?
Well, I think it's always been one of the core ideas within theosophical teachings. The degree to which that's been able to spread in terms of popularity would be hard for me to track. I do know that it's something that has been promoted from the beginning of the Theosophical Society. So probably, if you were to look at it, since the TS's founding, there have been a number of allied sorts of organizations and movements that have arisen. Many of them have drawn specific focuses from this larger context that the theosophical teachings have. So probably you could say that it has been popularized in the sense that many people who have been theosophists and gone on to develop other sorts of movements that focus specifically on meditation.